Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Comedy is a potent force. On any given worknight, millions of us turn to our favorite late-night hosts and the writers who put words in their mouths to provide a sort of palate cleanser after the real news is over. And yet the men, and they have mostly been men, who tell us jokes as we wind down at night have real influence. Their bits and interviews and one-liners both reflect and shape the national conversation on the events of the day, from the easy target gaffes and dalliances of politicians and celebrities to our ongoing debates about law, culture, economics, and national identity. Comedy writer and author John Max understands this power. He started his professional life as a political consultant, has written for the Emmys, Tonys, Golden Globes, and Academy Awards, and he was on staff with Jay Leno for all 22 years of his time hosting The Tonight Show. John Mack's new book is called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. John, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Your career trajectory has to be highly unusual. How did you go from running political campaigns to writing comedy?
Well, you know, you start out with a dirty secret in the family, which is that I am an attorney also. So when you start with that, you know, dirty secret, which we all try to hide. And when I was in law school, I started running campaigns, did it for years, went to Washington, D.C., did it in 41 states. And in 1990, Paul Simon, the senator, as opposed to the short singer, said, you know, John, I'm doing the gridiron speech. Can you write some jokes? And I wrote some jokes for Paul. Afterwards, I got a call from Frank Mankiewicz, who had put the speech together. Frank had been Bobby Kennedy's press secretary. He was a legendary Washington person. He said, John, you're really funny. You ought to do this for a living. And, you know, at first I thought, well, he's just trying to get me out of political consulting. But what happened was I saw that Jay was taking over The Tonight Show. I started sending in jokes just for fun. He started buying them, paying me a big $50 for every one he used. And then when he went to take over the show, he called me up and he said, would you like to join the staff? So I told my consulting partners, this is a 13-week job. I'll be back in 13 weeks. This is something I always wanted to do. And I went out there and it's been 22 years.
When you were in the thick of a campaign back when that was your full-time job, could you predict the kinds of things that would find their way into late-night monologues?
No, because it was a much different time, Chris. I mean, back then, again, Johnny Carson was the dominant. When I was doing campaigns, Carson was it. He was the Tonight Show, and that was – he was the king. But Johnny's monologue was a topical monologue, but it was a lot less political than it's been ever since Jay took over. So you wouldn't see the gaffes, the mistakes, the day-to-day things that we find funny make the monologues that are definitional. Johnny made the show big because, in the one sense, I mean, as you may remember, Bill Clinton went on after he gave that horrific speech at the Democratic Convention in 1988 and kind of resurrected his career. People thought he was a bad speaker. He went on Carson. He kind of talked about it. Everything was good. And then he went on Arsenio 4 years later when he was in third place and kind of defined the election that back then. But the bottom line was didn't have the impact that it does now.
You and many other comedy writers that you have worked with sort of grew up on Johnny Carson. What is his lasting legacy in the way that things are still done today?
Well, he really took the format. Steve Allen really invented the format with the he was the original Tonight Show host, but Steve was more, you know, variety sketch at late night and guest. But it was Johnny who gave that format that we know today, or that we've known for so many years, which is host comes out, does the monologue, does a comedy sketch, brings on two guests, then brings on the musician at the end, and there's your show. But it was Johnny also who first made it as opposed to a conversational monologue, which is what Jack Parr had done, it was a topical monologue. In fact, Carson's first joke was about Richard Nixon. And, you know, it was then Jay who came on right at the time when the 24-hour news cycle was, you know, becoming big. We had so much more information flowing in. People became much more interested in politics. You knew more about the gaffes, and Jay really took the monologue and put it on steroids.
Let's listen here to a little bit of Jay Leno, just a tiny bit of a monologue from, it sounds like the 90s.
Judge Ito said today, once they start deliberating, the jurors will not be allowed any conjugal visits until they arrive at a verdict. That's it. You know, that is a great idea. Why stop there? You know, if we want to solve our problems, tell Congress they can't have any conjugal visits until they pass health care, balance the budget, cut taxes. There you go. Boom. There you go. There you go. Thank you very much.
So it's all a little bit silly, but it's clear that it's grounded. Leonard's monologues are very much grounded in the events of the day.
Exactly. I'm guessing that was probably right around 94. Obviously, it was the OJ trial. 94, maybe 95, but it was when you had health care in the news. You had the looming government shutdown. So that was in the zeitgeist out there. People knew that the government was not doing things. So you take the story in the news. It's called an association joke. Take the big story in the news, which was OJ. Take the conjugal visits, which is a funny little twist in it, and then put it into something everyone knows.
I like this a lot. You said that you don't actually struggle, or you haven't throughout your career, with writer's block, because when you can't think of anything, what you do is take yourself through some exercises where you do really formulaic jokes just to get warmed up.
Right. There's two types of jokes I would do. The first is, and they were really invented by Johnny Carson, but it was the old, it's so hot, it's so cold. With Jay, we took it, the economy's so bad, gas prices are so high. So, you know, you do gas prices are so high that Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather are carpooling to their next fight. You know, or you do, you know, it's so cold out there, you know, Hillary Clinton and John Boehner are hugging for warmth. I mean, so you take those the formula, and then you write four or five jokes. It gets you going. It gets you in the flow. It gets you thinking. The other type of joke I would do is what I'll call the repeatable setup. Let's take Iran. There's always – the White House is every year announcing we're going to have new sanctions on Iran to really bring their government to its knees or something like that. That's the setup. But what is the punchline? The punchline could be, so we're going to send over Mitch McConnell. Or the punchline could be, so we're going to send over the Obama economic plan. Or we're going to have the Obamacare website send it over there. Or we're going to have Newt Gingrich shut it down. That repeatable setup, there's something that's been really present with us. Iran sanctions, you know, whatever it may be, a topic. And then you come back with a different punchline. That'll get me started as a writer. And at that point, I'm 10 jokes in and I'm on my way to my 100 a day.
You wrote 100 jokes a day. You said Leno would read 1,000 jokes a day, deciding what he wanted in his monologue.
Right. Some writers wrote 20 and everyone was a beauty. I was more of a volume person. I take a topic and pound it to death. Mm-hmm. You know, but I would try to get in 100 a day. Jay would read 1,000. Of those 1,000, about 100 would go on cards that he'd consider. To use, that would become the 25 or 30 that would make that night's monologue. Some of them from that day would stay over as possibilities for the next day. But honestly, Chris, the next day you'd come in, you'd start all over again. It'd be time for another 100 jokes for me.
So you couldn't take like 97 that didn't get used the night before and repitch them.
Yeah, you know, and so many times it was 100 out of 100 that didn't get used before, and that was pretty depressing. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, sometimes you could put a different angle, but my theory was that it's a bottomless well. So, you know, why give him something again that you know, that he didn't like or didn't think made the cut? Why not just hit a new topic? And one of the great things about a topical monologue versus being a comic, you know, a stand-up doing an act, is we're reacting off of incoming. So whatever is in the news, we're reacting off of and doing jokes on that. So there was a never-ending supply of fresh ideas coming in. We just had to find the twist.
So, John, the shows that are on, like Comedy Central, have been pretty overtly political and left-leaning, right? The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the recently departed Colbert Report. But I'm wondering if shows like The Tonight Show, when you were working on it with Jay Leno, that are not necessarily taking a political viewpoint, were there writers across the political spectrum, or did everybody lean a little to the left or to the right, or did that even, really figure into the decisions about who would get hired?
I mean, you know, I kind of talk about this in the book a little bit. Our writers were across the board. I mean, there was people to the left of Che Guevara. You know, there's a couple people to the right of Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. But what you really had is we were first and foremost a comedy writers. So even though I am a Democrat, as people know, and I continue to work and help Democrats, when you walk into the studio to write jokes, when you walk into your office, it's comedy first. So it doesn't matter to me what political party the emperor is. If the emperor is wearing no clothes, and as we know, the emperor has often had his clothes off, we would do jokes about that. And I think everyone felt the same. You know, the key was, Chris, what's the best joke?
Of the politicians you've known well, how many have been genuinely funny when nobody is feeding them jokes?
Oh, that's a pretty small and select group. You know, people always would tell me that Al Gore is very funny in person. I've met Al Gore, I've been with him, and there was never really a lot of laughs. Joe Biden makes me laugh. Joe Biden, and I know Joe, and I've been with him, and I don't mean just he makes me laugh in terms of sometimes he's a comic figure, but he's a genuinely funny guy. It's the guy who you go to work with, you know, lunch bucket Joe. He is good. Clinton is very funny. President Clinton, very, very funny in person, you know, back and forth. President Obama, with the few times I've been with him, takes himself very seriously and doesn't, you know, I'm sure he is perhaps with people he knows better. But when I've been around him, it was never anything where you go, what he said was hysterical.
What's interesting about that, and you mentioned Clinton and Biden, both of whom, you know, Biden certainly has just sort of put his foot in his mouth more than once. And as we know, former President Clinton got himself into all kinds of trouble. I wonder if, you know, to be funny, you have to take a risk now and then. You have to say things and do things that you can't be absolutely certain are going to play well.
Right. Well, to me, a political figure, first of all, you know, you take the White House Correspondents' Dinner and everyone said the president was fantastic. The president's fantastic every year, regardless of who the president is, because you're there geared to laugh at him. To me, it's what senators, what governors, what second level political figures are really funny. And to me, those are the ones who are self-deprecating. Those are the ones who can really make me laugh. So one year at the Gridiron, I'll never forget, Bill Clinton opened up by saying he was doing the Gridiron. He started up by saying, I guess you're wondering why I'm here. And he said, well, Dancing with the Stars turned me down. And Arnold Schwarzenegger had a great joke when he was, before he actually ran for office, he would open up his roast and speeches and motivational speeches by saying this. He'd go, I'm living proof that anyone can come to America and become a millionaire if they work hard, they study hard, and they marry a Kennedy. So right there, he was acknowledging the fact that he was married to a very rich woman.
Jack Paar famously walked off The Tonight Show in 1960 to protest network censorship. I was fascinated to read in your book that in real life, the people who decide what does and doesn't make broadcast air on the networks tend to be pretty foul-mouthed and funny.
They really are. I mean, it was amazing to me that, you know, you would think that someone who's in standards and practices, or as we call them, the censors, you know, that they would be, you know, some, you know, it would be, you know, that uptight, you know, uptight nun from Catholic school. But it's not. They tend, you know, first of all, they read everything. Mm-hmm. So they have a very good sense of humor. They know, you know, they have their limits. They know what can be done. But they're in real life, they're very, very funny, warm people who like a good dirty joke as much as anyone. But the minute they put their hat on, it's like, I'm sorry, you cannot say the word water closet. What? Really? You know, so
that was the issue with Jack Paar, right?
Right. He did a joke about water closet, which is, I guess, English for bathroom. And it's like, that was 1960. Fast forward to today and what you can use on the air. And you go, really? You know? So, I mean, to me, and as someone who is a comedy writer, I am a firm believer in the First Amendment and free speech, and that let the audience determine whether it's funny or not.
John Max is my guest. He was on staff with Jay Leno at The Tonight Show for 22 years, and he has a new book out called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
We put together a list of phrases that you will never hear. We started this about a month ago, and we said probably one phrase that's the least often used phrase in the entire world was, "That's the banjo player's Porsche." you just don't hear that very often. So we came up with some phrases. We guarantee these will just never come up in casual conversation. "That's Mr. Rogers to you, and stay the hell out of my neighborhood." "Waiter, more wine, and more of those McNuggets." "Mr. DeVito, I'm down here."
That, of course, was Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson was the predecessor of the man that my guest wrote comedy for 22 years, Jay Leno. We're speaking with John Max, a comedy writer and author of the new book, Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, John, what would you call the series of jokes we just heard from Johnny Carson? Is there a term for that kind of list of funny phrases and concepts?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's your basic sketch. You have one setup. So, you know, again, it's like Letterman's top 10 list, or it's Steve Martin's I Believe, or Billy Crystal's What Were They Thinking, or any of Jay's bits, where you take one concept like that. And in Johnny's case, it was there phrases you're just not going to hear. So everyone gets it, and it gives you the ability to do 10 punchlines in quick succession. Now, Johnny, because of the day and age, he would just sit at the desk and he would read them. If Jay were doing that, back in our day, we would have a picture behind him. We would have a visual. So would Billy Crystal at the Oscars for, say, What Are They Thinking? Or something like that. So you get the double punch. You get the joke itself. You hear it. You also see a picture to make it even funnier.
What was the role of Ed McMahon? I mean, was he a funny guy on his own? He never really made any jokes, but he was always there with that deep chuckle. And I know he was before your time on The Tonight Show. But do you think, I mean, there are still some guys who have those sort of sidekicks helping to remind the audience of what's funny.
Right. It's two things. If you hear, again, it's in essence a human laugh track. And I don't mean that to diminish it. But you see people laughing, it signals to you or you hear them that they should laugh. And also in Johnny's case or in Conan's case with Andy Richter, you know, it gives them a chance to play off of somebody. It gives them a chance for a little bit of a back and forth, which can really add it. So you're not just there trying to generate your own ideas. You're listening to what the other person's saying, and it's giving you something to play off of. Quick 30-second story. A few years ago, Ed McMahon, I had another book out a few years ago. Ed McMahon had me on one of his radio shows. He gets on, he goes, "I didn't read the book, I know nothing about it, but you're a Tonight Show guy." I get on, and he spends 5 minutes talking about the greatest book he's ever read. "You must buy it right now." He never asked me a question. He just did a 5-minute ad for it, and they said, "That's all the time we have with John Max, but thank you, John." I never said a word in the entire 5 minutes.
I guess that's one way to do an interview.
Absolutely.
You also write about people who are just really excellent guests, and you have a whole list of them, and you make a point of putting them in no particular order. But what makes a guy like Billy Crystal a really good guest on a late night show?
I mean, in Billy's case, and the same with a Marty Short or Steve Martin, they come totally prepared. They have they know the comedy they want to do. They know the bits. They know the host, and they listen. So there's a back and forth. You know, when a host is not a great interviewer, you can see they keep trying to force things in. And when a guest isn't a great guest, they'll just keep trying to plug their movie. Billy Crystal knows he's got a movie coming out or he's got a TV show. He knows the host is going to get to it. The most important thing is to seem real and to have a funny conversation. So when Billy will come on a show, he'll have, you know, for his 2 7-minute segments, he could go for 25 minutes if need be. He's prepared.
And he's basically written his own jokes for the night. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, he'll come in. You know, some people do more jokes. Some people do more stories. I'm putting this apart from a stand-up who comes on and does his six-minute routine.
Right.
I'm talking about a guest like a Marty or Billy who sits down and has a conversation with a Jay or a Dave or a Conan or a Jimmy. And in that case, they know what they want to do. And a few years ago, Billy had this fantastic story. He called me in advance and he told me, I'm going on Letterman. I'm going to do the raccoon story. And I knew exactly what it was. We had talked about it. He had had a raccoon that was tormenting him at home. He'd go out at night. He'd go out to dinner with Janice. He'd open the door and the raccoon would be staring at him. And so he just took that and built that into a 14-minute bit that's hysterical.
Terry Bradshaw, I don't know that I've seen him interviewed, and I wouldn't have thought he'd be just a hilarious guest.
He's funny because for a couple of reasons. One, he's energetic. Mm-hmm. Two, he's not just there to sell, you know, his Sunday football show or whatever. He's there just to be entertaining. Three, he's got that great Southern charm and the storytelling ability. And he's also knows that Jay, and I think Terry was on our show, I think, 50 times. He knows that Jay's going to make fun of him, and he likes it. So he would come on, and he would start out, and he said, Jay, I'm going to do stand-up. I know how to do stand-up. And he would go tell six horrific jokes on purpose, knowing that Jay would then hammer him, and then he could come back.
Not surprising, I guess, that you say Arsenio Hall. Of course, he's hosted then and now, and he's also a good guest.
Yeah, Arsenio's a very good guest because, again, in the end, it starts from the fact he was a stand-up, and he's also an actor. He also, as someone who's hosted, he knows what it takes. So, again, comes on prepared, willing to play, and conversational.
He looks exactly the same as he did, whatever, 25 years ago when he had his just huge moment, Arsenio Hall. But the second show, the new iteration hasn't worked quite as well, or it hasn't made the kind of splash that he did the first time around. Do you think it was ill-advised for him to come back?
You know, again, I don't know if he was ill-advised, but he was so perfect for 1987, 88, 89, 90, 91, 92. He was hip. He was fresh. He was completely new. And he basically came back, even though he looked the same, he is an Arsenio that is 20 years older when he came back. And he was basically the same Arsenio doing the same show. And I think the time had passed him by just being looking hip and being different, which he was because he was the one person of color when there was no one else like that on late night. Now you've got a little bit more of a variety, and I just think he didn't quite – it didn't have the energy that he had the first time around.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Austin in Dallas. Hey, Austin.
Hi. Hey, Chris. Hey, I got a question for the guest. And this is as a guy who loves open mic stand-up comedy. I was wondering, what advice would you give? You know, when you see those guys up on the stage and they're just not funny, like, what advice would you give them?
You know, it's really a two-part thing. To start with, you know, something Chris Rock told me. He said, one thing that he's got, and I agree, he has jokes. A lot of, you know, the comics you see at open mic night, they have attitude and no jokes. You know, next best is jokes but no real performance. The ones who are really going to make it are ones who come in with plenty of jokes and they actually can perform them. I mean, there are a lot of people up there who stand there, you know, they've got stage fright. They just read jokes that could be funny, but they have no personality. So if I were advising someone out there, I'd say if you're planning to do 5 minutes, write. Come in there. If you're going to do 5 minutes, you need 100 jokes that you're trying out over the course of several different times. Weed them out. What happens is these comics say, oh, the audience should have gotten that. And they keep trying to do the same joke that doesn't work. It's not the audience's fault. It's yours. Start with 100, get 3 that work, come back a couple of days later with another 100. Try what you can. Keep building your act that way.
Talk about the push and pull when you and a team are writing for someone specific over a number of years, like Jay Leno. Does the team tend to take on the sensibility of Jay Leno, or does Jay Leno ultimately find his sensibility shaped by the people who are writing for him?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is probably we take on his sensibility is 80%, and probably a little bit is not so much the sensibility. But if we are all writing jokes about one particular topic, I mean, that's signaling to Jay because, you know, that, hey, this is something that's probably in the news because every one of my writers is writing about the fact that Joe Biden just groped the Secretary of Defense's wife. So I think that's a signal. Okay, that's in the zeitgeist. That's out there. That's in the news. Maybe we should consider it if it's a good joke.
With topical humor, you're going to, you know, sometimes there are things in the news that are so serious that they're hard to joke about. You were writing for Jay Leno when 9/11 happened. Can you talk about, you know, those moments when no one felt like anybody could get out and tell jokes ever again, and what it took to sort of decide how to get back to it?
Yeah, it's, you know, again, right now it's got to be very tough, you know, with what happened in Baltimore for late night comics to be, you know, tackling things. But again, that's not to the level, not to diminish it. But September 11th was such a defining moment. And, you know, when everyone came back on, Letterman was masterful when he came back on. I think Jay was fantastic when he came back on. And those first few nights, they really just talked about the event. They were a listening post for all of us. But then you got to do jokes. And Jay kind of explained it really well, I thought, when he said, well, because I'm not saying my job's important, because but this is what I do. And if I can, he said, he likened himself to a cookie you give to a firefighter. He said, if I can take that firefighter's mind off of what he's just seen, he or she's just seen, for a few minutes, then we've done our job. So you start with the jokes, which I call the silly jokes. You know, a survey says that, you know, 80% of babies are born or, you know, born in July or conceived in March or something like that. You take a silly survey, a silly study, what we call a man in Belgium joke, where someone in Belgium does something funny. It's an old comedy writer's thing referring to that. And you do that. And then eventually you find what I'll call the crazy cast of characters. So no one's going to make a joke about the actual tragedy of September 11th. But you start to find out about Osama bin Laden, and you find out that he has 55 brothers and sisters, and he's the 27th. And it's always the middle child that's the problem. So, I mean, you take – you then say, okay, we're making fun of that. And that making fun of the enemy, making fun of the person who is we want to dislike, that goes back to Charlie Chaplin with Hitler. That goes back to Jack Benny to have – you know, in his movies where you do that. And eventually, as you move on, the cast of characters becomes more interesting, funnier, and we move away from the event. Again, for 1 second, the OJ trial, a double murder. You're not going to want to do jokes about that tragedy. But then all of a sudden you have, you know, Marsha Clark, you have Christopher Darden, you have Cato Kalin, you have the dog that wouldn't bark, the gloves, the shoes, Johnny Cochran. You have a cast of characters you can make fun of.
Sometimes it doesn't quite work out the way history decides on things. And you're really candid here about your regrets after everybody took on Richard Jewell, the man who was believed to have committed the Atlanta Olympic Park bombing that, as it turns out, was completely innocent.
Yeah, it was 1996, and the story breaks, and, you know, there's a rush to judgment in the news. And, you know, Richard Jewell, main suspect. And, you know, you look at him and he kind of just looked like a guy who was a little goofy and became a very easy target. Like I said, the late night shows didn't convict him by any stretch of the imagination, but we followed the lead of the press and we amplified it. And I feel horrible about that because he was 100% completely innocent doing his job, as we all found out later on. And in retrospect, I should have, as somebody who wrote jokes, taken that half step back and said, you know, this is not a public figure. This is a human being. Let's wait a little bit. But, you know, sometimes you're in a rush to get on a good joke and what you think is a good joke. And I regret that.
There are some jokes that seem to write themselves based on just events in the news. And I'm thinking of someone like Anthony Weiner and how you challenge yourself to stay creative and not just, you know what I mean? Like there have to be different ways to tell jokes about something that is so obviously joke material.
Right. I mean, in one sense, you got to do the layup sometimes. You got to take the easy joke because in the end, you're doing 25 or 30 jokes.
Yeah.
And the man's name was Weiner. I mean, you can't change that. It's an easy joke. And everyone would say, oh, my gosh, how could you do that? It's the second and third level jokes. You do five or six on that, and then you get to the next level. So if I were doing those jokes today, if that story broke, so let's say a month ago, I would go to a hopefully smarter joke, which is say, now we will understand why Hillary Clinton's erased all her emails. She's got stuff from Anthony Weiner. So I would take it to another level in that case.
Is there a point at which you decide, okay, I'm done with this. I've got to move on, even though it remains funny?
You know, I call jokes have career value and peak value. So there are people in the news and events that happen. If you remember from a few years ago, there was the tanning mom. And, you know, she was, and then there was the runaway bride. And then there was the astronaut who drove across country.
Right. The diaper on.
Right, the diaper on. And something like that, you really pound for until the last stop. And you don't bring them back. You're not going to hear a tanning mom joke in 2015. But then there's people, what I call, who have career value. You know, those are people who are in the public news who we know so well. And that could be a Bill Clinton. That could be a Hillary Clinton. That could be, you know, oftentimes they're political figures. They might be the out-of-control celebrity. Could be Charlie Sheen. Use those judiciously. You know, you don't want to pound them every night, but you bring them back every once in a while because people know them. You don't have to explain. If I were doing a joke right now about Martin O'Malley, who is running for president, I would have to spend a good part of the setup explaining who he is. In 6 months, I won't. People will know who he is. And at that point, I just say, you know, Martin O'Malley, bam, set up, twist, punchline.
How often have you met people that you've written jokes about that wouldn't necessarily be happy with them? I'm thinking about someone like a Monica Lewinsky, who, although, you know, she was certainly the butt of many, many jokes, was not a famous public figure when all of this broke and really was quite young and at the age when a lot of people do dumb things.
Right. You know, it's first of all, well, I'll answer that in a second. But the answer to your first question is far too often if I run to people, especially in politics. And most of them, the pros are pretty good. This is John Max from The Tonight Show. Yeah, I like what Jay did last night, you know, and they'll kind of laugh. And I always have the standard answer. It wasn't mine.
Right. True or not,
by the way, I would, you know something? I was not under oath. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a situation like a Monica Lewinsky where, you know, if I see what she's doing now and the speeches she's giving and the articles she's writing, and I look back and say, you know, if I had thought about what she's saying now back in 1998, I would not have done those jokes.
Of course, you might not have had your job back then if you hadn't done those jokes.
Right, exactly. Again, in the end, it was, you know, I understand her point of view and, again, a little bit of regret.
Comedy writer John Max is my guest. He was on staff with Jay Leno at The Tonight Show for 22 years. His newest book is called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with comedy writer John Max, whose new book is called Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. John, what would you say political candidates have to think about before they decide, are they going to do late night comedy shows? Will they pick The Tonight Show? Will they pick will they pick Letterman or who they'll go and appear with?
You know, I mean, let me put on my political consultant hat for a second.
Okay.
You know, from the old days, if I were doing that, my first question would be, how do I want to be defined? Am I using this to just announce? Am I using this to address a problem people think I'm not interesting? Am I using this to talk about a scandal? And the second thing I would do is, besides figuring out why I'm going on, is who's the audience? If you were going on David Letterman, you would know who that audience was. If you were going on Jay, if you wanted to do well in the heartland, I mean, Jay's biggest audiences were St. Louis, Chicago, Milwaukee, Denver, Charlotte. So you might say, well, you know, I've got to appeal more to that. But in the end, going on a late night show for a political candidate really allows you to define yourself in a way that people find more acceptable. If you're on Meet the Press voters are more informed, I would say, and they're kind of had their minds made up. You go on a late night show, the voters are not quite as obsessed with politics as the press viewer. They're going to be watching it, and they're going to really get a sense of who you know, he or she is.
How much did the ratings matter to you?
Well, again, it's, you know, let's not forget in the word show business, the word with a capital I is business.
Right.
So it mattered in, you know, two ways. It mattered, you know, I think to us, because obviously if the ratings are good, you feel the show will continue and you'll have a job. And if the ratings are not good, you know, they will find someone to replace you. So in one sense, you always have that. How do we make the show better? How do we keep people watching? The other, and this goes more just to me personally, is the competitive nature. You want to be number one. You know, you don't want to be number two. You want more people to be watching you, and you have a sense that then more people are listening to your jokes, and you're making more people laugh. So from my perspective, it was always, you know, I was striving every day, what are the best 100 jokes I can give?
You write that it was a turning point for Jay Leno on The Tonight Show when Hugh Grant went on to talk about his arrest with a prostitute. What was it about the way Jay handled that interview that caused people to take notice of what he was trying to do there?
You know, it's interesting because we were in second place. Then Dave Letterman was in first in the ratings. And excuse me. And what happened was Hugh had a movie coming out. I believe it was called 9 Months. And he scheduled to come on right in July when the movie was coming out. And we were on a hiatus before that, a week off. And during that time, Hugh Grant got in trouble with a woman of the night named Divine Brown. Now, we kept thinking he's going to cancel. He's not going to cancel. What's going to happen? He shows up. And, you know, obviously we made jokes about him in the monologue. He sits down next to Jay. And Jay said, "What the hell were you thinking?" So two things. One, instead of the usual 4 million people watching us that night, 10 million were watching.
Hmm.
Two, they saw he had a really good show, and they started to watch on a nightly basis. Three, he spoke for all of us. That's the question each of us was saying. Why would a guy as good-looking as Hugh Grant, who could obviously date just about and had dated just about anyone he wanted, why was he out there at 2 a.m. with a hooker? And, you know, from that perspective, Jay asked that question. And that's one of the things Jay, and I think all late-night hosts do, started with Johnny, it certainly continued with Jay. They speak for all of us. When an earthquake happens in L.A. in 1994, you know, he picked on the villain, Mother Nature. He did the jokes. He made us laugh. And again, we had an earthquake the other night here again. If we were on, we would do, I'm sure, just updated versions of those jokes. But they speak for all of us in those situations, Chris.
Do you have to temper the monologue when it refers to a guest who's been involved in some topical things at all if they're coming on that night? Is there any fear that the guest will hear this in the green room and say, forget it, I'm not walking out there?
Jay, it's a great question. Jay's theory always was, you're a guest in his house. So he is not going to come on and slam you. At the same time, you can't not address the fact that Hugh Grant is on and has been arrested. It was, you know, for that 48 or 72 hours, the biggest story in the country. So you do jokes about them, but they're not the vicious pounding. You know, you basically say, well, we're going to talk about this with Hugh in a few minutes when he's on the show, but did you see what happened? And you do it and you get into it that way. But at the same time, you're not going to insult a guest in your house.
What can you tell us about let's just talk about the writers. Did you at the Tonight Show, did you guys have a thing against the writers at Letterman?
No, not at all. To me, I have, for anyone who does this for a living, and again, I'm not saying it's rocket science. I'm not saying it's brain surgery. We're writing jokes. I get that, ladies and gentlemen. It's not the most important thing in the world. But if you play Major League Baseball, you have a respect for every other Major League Baseball player. If you are a Tony-nominated actor, actress, you have respect for everyone else who does that. And in my case, and I think for all of us, I have tremendous respect for the Letterman writers. Bill Sheff, you know, the Stengel brothers, Matt Roberts, every one of them, they do a great job, as do all the writers on the show. If you do that night after night, you're right there in the major leagues as far as I'm concerned.
How often does it happen? I mean, I don't know how much time when you're actively trying to do all that writing and you have to keep up with the news. I don't know how much time you have to, you know, keep up with what goes viral these days the next day. But I wonder if you're on the lookout for some other writer who had the same idea as you and wrote a very similar joke, and if that's just a crushing blow.
You know, again, if they get it in first, I mean, there was always the somebody will see a joke that Jay told, and you know, you're sitting around with the writers after and go, yeah, I had that joke, and somebody goes, well, no, that was my joke. Well, no, I did it, because in the end, on some topics, you're going to hit the same joke. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's just natural, you know, that you're going to do it. You know, Vice, and again, I don't want to go back to Joe Biden, who I like, but Vice President Biden, you know, is in a picture where he appears to be groping the wife of the Secretary of Defense. You know, and everyone's going to write the joke, this is the first time in history a vice president has been accused of doing anything. Do you know what I mean? So we're all going to write that basic joke. And, you know, chances are it's not going to get in. But if it does, there's going to be eight writers going, it was mine.
Why is late night comedy dominated by white men?
It's again, a good question, and it shouldn't be. I don't know what the networks are thinking. I would love to see – I love Chelsea Handler's show when it's on. I'm thrilled she's coming back. I'd love to see Amy Schumer get a show. Amy Poehler would be fantastic having a show. When Wanda Sykes had her show, I mean, I watched that every night. You know, it made me laugh. It was a great show. I'd love to see Wanda get another shot. It makes no sense to me. And I wish I knew that there was a reason other than the fact that the network executives are probably – older white men, and they do that. But when I'm a network executive, Chris, and I'm sure that will happen soon, trust me, you get a show, Wanda Sykes gets a show, and Amy Poehler gets a show.
All right, perfect. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Clark in Weatherford. Hi, Clark.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This guy, John, right?
John.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Whoopi Goldberg. I heard she's going to be in a movie playing Moms Mabley.
You know, I've worked for Whoopi. I did, I think, 3 Oscars with her, and I did Hollywood Squares with her. I think, and I might be wrong on this, she did a documentary on Moms Mabley a few years ago. But I know Whoopi has always been a huge fan of hers and would be fantastic in that part.
How do the hosts, or maybe you can just speak to Jay Leno, but in terms of like preserving his energy throughout the day for the time when he actually gets up there, I guess you guys taped it, what, like early evening typically?
Well, 5 o'clock and then 4 o'clock, okay. You know, depending. In the end, it was at 4 o'clock.
Yeah. How did it work for him? Was he pretty quiet throughout the work day? And then once he went on stage, he would light up?
He's not human. He's the most energetic person in the entire world. This is a guy who would get there at 7:30. He would start reading jokes. He would work out. He'd be in his office making phone calls, having meetings with executives, reading jokes till 1:30. 12 o'clock, I'm sorry, he'd go in. He'd be briefed on who the people were coming on the show. 1:30, he'd go downstairs, and he would 1:30 to quarter to, they'd put together the final monologue. 2 o'clock, he would do rehearsal of the bits for that night. 3 o'clock, he would do the reading of the monologue and reading the cue cards. He would then go out and warm up the audience at times. Then afterwards at night, he would do a show, high energy, and then afterwards he would go shoot bits, the tape pieces for the next day. When I say there's some comics that are always on, there's some who are, who are off until the light goes on. And in Jay's case, he was just, you know, the highest energy person I've ever met.
How have you how do you evaluate Jimmy Fallon now in that spot?
I think Jimmy's doing a great job. Again, he's redefined the show for 2015. Jay was a monologue-centric show, joke, 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 joke. Jimmy Fallon understands that in this day and age that what's important sometimes is getting that clip that is going to go viral, that maybe only 4 million people are watching your show that night, but if you have 10 million sets of eyeballs on a clip of Morgan Freeman doing helium and talking, that's something people are going to be aware of your show. I think he's done a fantastic job.
The thing that always strikes me about Jimmy Fallon is that he appears to be having the best time of his life. And that can't possibly be true every single night, but he fakes it very well.
You know, I know Jimmy a little bit, and I think it really is true. Hmm. I think he knows that, as Jay always said, I have the best job in the world. I think Jimmy knows he's got the best job in the world now. And I think every day, yeah, again, obviously there's days where you have a fight with the wife, you know, the kid's crying, you know, somebody, you know, hits you as you came out of the parking lot. But I think, by and large, Jimmy really loves the job. And that love of doing it is infectious, and that's why celebrities like to come on a show.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have David on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a great show. I have a question for you. So I did stand up in L.A. in the early 2000s, and I would do bringer nights and open mic nights. I now teach improv to kids here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. What advice would I give them if they, you know, out of high school, want to make a career in comedy, whether it's writing or doing stand-up? Where should they go? What should they do? What advice would you give?
The first advice I'd give them was to go to the Penguin website and buy my book. Okay, my second advice, the real advice I would give would be this. They need to look at the comics who are out there. They need to go and see the greats in concert. They need to go, and when they're watching a Conan monologue or a Fallon or a Kimmel or whatever, I always said, type it out. Get the rhythm. Get the words. The more they can look at those who are great in doing it, get a book called Tim and Tom, which is about Tom Dreesen and Tim Reed, and see the process they had as they rose to the top. That's the thing I would do so that they can learn that. I don't think, you know, buying the book on how to write a joke is going to work as much as absorbing and watching and listening. So that would be my advice.
You wrote a book about 12 years ago called How to Be Funny. And when I looked at it, I have not read the book. I just saw it online today when I was researching. It occurred to me that I wondered if the people who bought this are like the least funny people in America and if it would actually work. Can you teach somebody to be funny who is not naturally funny?
It's hard. What you can do is you can the original concept of the book was to teach public speakers. It was a much more narrow book aimed at a CEO type audience. How do we get public speakers? And because I write a lot of speeches and work with a lot of people in media consulting, how they should present themselves. It was the idea is how they can add humor to speeches and remarks. The book, as time went on, broadened out and became more of how to be funny for everyone. And I suspect that what happened is the people that did buy it were more people who were desperately unfunny and looking for the magic beans. Whereas I in retrospect, if I'd gone back or if I was doing an update, I would narrow it down again to those who are public speakers who are already out there, have some platform, and how they can use humor better.
Who of all the people, maybe it's Jay Leno, but of all the people who have read your jokes, who just delivers them precisely the way that you would voice them yourself?
Me. But besides me, Jay does a great job. But again, it's hard because I write for Marty Short and I write for Billy Crystal and I do some writing for Chris Rock. I'm writing them in their voice and in their style. So it's not like it's just lines on a piece of paper. What I would write for Jay Leno would be totally different from what I would write for Marty Short. So for each of them, they're delivering them perfectly, but I think it's because I'm writing how they would say them.
So you're writing to their voice rather than the other way around.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I understand that they're the ones on stage. I'm merely the guy providing the idea, the twist, and the punchline, and putting it in the wording and voice I think that will best work for them.
You feel any pull to go back to this kind of nightly schedule, or are you done with that?
You know, again, in the end, I would never turn down $1 million check. I mean, let's be honest. Probably even 500 grand. The answer is I wake up every morning and I say, you know, today I would like to make jokes about A, B, and C. Luckily, I have other outlets with the comics I write for and award shows and things like that. But, you know, again, every once in a while, yeah, I think I'd like to go one more round on late night.
John Max has written for the Emmys, the Tonys, the Golden Globes, the Academy Awards, and spent 22 years on staff with Jay Leno. His new book is Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. John, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Oh, and thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.